Hello all, welcome to the Pyramid Podcast, where three lads discuss all things the English football pyramid. On today's episode, Man United throw away another two-goal lead. Is it time to sack Erik ten Hag? We'll preview their trip to Villa Park, who beat Bayern Munich in Champions League this week. We'll have a roundup of the key EFL stories, including Leeds at Sunderland and Friday Night Football. And we'll finish with Laura, who provide us our weekly YTFC update. I'm your host, Alex Murphy, and once again, I'm joined by Tom Gallagher and Tom Lawrence. Let's start at the Estádio do Dragão in Portugal. Tomo, United 2-0 up after 20 minutes, looked to be on their way to a much-needed victory, but as happened time and time again, they absolutely crumbled.
Yeah, they did crumble. And the worrying thing is, I guess, for Ten Hag in particular, is that we showed this kind of lack of mentality a lot last season. You think back to that Coventry game. When you're 3-0 up with, 15, 20 minutes to go, and it ends up going to extra time penalties. And the same things happen again this season. There's a fragile mentality within that squad that when something goes wrong, i.e. a red card or you concede a goal, there's no kind of leaders on the pitch that grabs the game by the scruff of the neck and just calms everything down. And the chaos just continues, and we very often concede a second goal within 10 minutes of conceded the first goal. And it feels like United, to be honest, Ten Hag's a dead man walking, really. It feels like we are in this sort of state of purgatory where the players seem to be almost in this purgatory where they think Ten Hag should be sacked. They think, or they expect, he will be sacked. They probably expected him to be sacked in the summer. And when he wasn't, they were umming and ahhing about, well, where's the direction? And I was one of the United fans who wanted to give Ten Hag a second chance for the season, because the FA Cup win against City was so significant in my eyes. But also what was quite significant was the fact we had so many injuries last year. But Ten Hag, and obviously Ten Hag used that as an excuse quite a lot. And now he can't use that excuse this season. And we basically looked exactly the same as we did last season, as we have done this season. So, yeah, it's time to call it a day. I don't know. You listen to all these reports saying he's got the Porto game and he's got the Villa game. I don't sort of get that sort of football strategy where you're giving a man who's got 2.5 years of sort of evidence under his belt, and you're giving him two games to prove himself. Like, if he wins those games flukily by, say, Villa, or if he wins on Sunday because Villa get a man sent off in the first 10 minutes, does that mean he saves his job? It's all a bit silly, to be honest, and I feel like a decision needs to be made.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually, because United were 2-0 up, but they weren't cruising, were they? Two goalkeeper mistakes by someone who'd been bigged up in the preview to the game. Diego Costa, you know, widely regarded as one of the best keepers in the world, but he should have done better with both goals. And United looked terrible from the outset. Like, they were going down the right-hand side. This whole Dalot playing left-back and inverting looks absolutely shocking tactics. It doesn't work. Martinez seemed so exposed yesterday down that right flank for Porto. But as you say, he's now getting to the situation now where he's got his goalkeeper in goal. He's got a right back in Mazraoui. Obviously, Dalot's covering but plays every game for Man United. He's then got Martinez, who he signed, De Ligt, who's an old Ajax player. So he's literally got his own back five now, and they still look defensively, Loro, so, so poor.
Yeah, I mean, the intricacies of Manchester United, I think it's better for you two to discuss, because you analyse every minute of every game and watch them and care about them. But I feel sorry for our listeners, because they're hearing me like a parrot. I said this exact thing a year ago. I said that Ten Hag's not good enough or big enough to be the manager of Manchester United Football Club, and nothing's going to change as far as he's still there. I also indicated that you should have appointed Roberto De Zerbi, because I think he'd have lit some fire underneath everything and got rid of the deadwood, and probably injected some excitement back into the club alongside what's happened in the back room, which we thought was going to be good. And I know that's going to take time, but I think, as you both have mentioned before, it feels like this summer has been very similar to lots of other summers we've had before that haven't beared much fruit. So I don't want to keep labouring the point about Man United's poor performance when, I think I had the answer a year ago. And that's that the manager's got to go. So I haven't got too much more to say on Man United other than nothing's going to change until you get someone in there that is good enough to do the job.
Do you know what as well, Murph, before you come in, a damning indictment on last night's sort of game was Robbie Savage was on CoComs on TNT and he was dissecting it and analysing it at half-time, or sorry, during the first half, much better than Ten Hag has ever done. So he was saying, look, this is the reason why United are struggling. And he was sort of like picking out positions that players needed to be. And to be fair, he's been a very good co-commentator, something you almost may not associate with Robbie Savage so much. But if Robbie Savage can see it, why can't Ten Hag? Do you know what I mean? And it feels like maybe Ten Hag can see it and he's instructing the players on how to solve these issues, but the players are just not heeding his instructions anymore. And once the players stop listening to the manager's instructions, then there's only one sort of natural end to that, and that's basically getting rid of him.
And another thing I thought last night with Ten Hag was after the game, I sort of stayed up to listen to him speak because I wanted to hear just what he had to say about it. But I was really interested about the Marcus Rashford substitution. And it seemed like he had to be injured. But then I was like, I'm not sure how he can be, because the last action in the first half was him going past three or four people and just not quite getting the shot off to make it 3-2. But Ten Hag's come out afterwards and said that was tactical and it was rotation. So to me, that was almost a premeditated substitution. Rashford was coming off regardless for Garnacho because he's struggling with those whole keeping those wingers happy for rotation. So to have to do that premeditated without taking into account the actual game where Rashford was causing their right-hand side big problems, I think is another real damning indictment on Ten Hag.
Do you know as well, Murph, do you remember when I was manager of our Sunday league team and I was rotating basically three strikers for two strikers, basically. So every week, one of the strikers played on the bench. And it feels like Ten Hag's doing that this season with Garnacho and Rashford. And he's almost ignoring the fact that you're paying these guys 350 grand a week, 200 grand a week, whatever it might be. And you're playing professional football and you're just giving them a half each to keep them happy. It's absolutely ridiculous. You're not taking into consideration the context of the game. If I was that right back, a Porto right back last night, and I saw Rashford come off at half time, I would have been thanking my lucky stars because Rashford had him in his pocket for 45 minutes. One thing I will say about Rashford's sort of first half performance was that defensively, that's where we were getting exposed on Dalot's side and Rashford's side. Now, Rashford, obviously, is more of a striker, I would say, than a natural midfielder winger. So clearly Porto were trying to expose that, and they did that with both of their goals. So maybe Ten Hag's just come out and said it was a bit of rotation, but actually in the dressing room they've had a bit of a to-do and he's just said, right, you're coming off at Garnacho. You don't really know, and I wonder if maybe that will come out in the wash in the next couple of days before Villa.
Yeah, I have 2 points. The first one is, yeah, you're bang right about Rashford there. And it's not helped by the fact that he's got this tactic where Mazraoui and Dalot just have to invert and play in midfield. It's exposing both centre-backs. And the second point was, you are a shocking coach rotating three strikers in two positions when Dias clearly should have just been benched. But anyway, that's all in the past. So look, one final point on United, because I know we talk about them a lot, but they are just always in the news. Tom, I just want to touch on the Bruno red card. Obviously, the first one's been rescinded, but the fact is he gave the referee a decision to make in a big game against Tottenham when it's not going our way. And then I thought again yesterday, two high foots is a really, really poor way for a captain to be sent off in a big game where your manager needs you to probably win to keep his job. And it's not going your way away from home.
It's an example. Both those red cards actually are an example of Bruno just being pissed off and frustrated with his own form, because he's probably 12 matches at the start of the season has probably been his worst run of form for Manchester United in the sort of three or four years he's been here. That Maddison challenge at the weekend, although it was probably a tad harsh to be a red card, it was clear that he was just pissed off that Maddison was running rings around him. And the same goes for last night. It almost both of the challenges sort of struck of desperation, because he wanted to make something happen, because he hasn't been making anything happen over the course of the season. And yeah, it's sad to see, really, because that's Manchester United's captain. And he's a sort of agent of chaos, and it sort of it reflects quite well on the club right now, because the club's very chaotic.
Yeah, I wonder long term whether Bruno is going to be starting for Man United if a manager came in who didn't want that chaos, whether he'd be someone who'd still start. He, as you say, he is very good at that kind of like playing a long through ball over the top to Rashford, but he gives the ball away multiple times per game. And that might be that, you know, there's some coaching that could happen which would change the way he plays. But I do sometimes wonder, for all of his stats that he ends up getting come the end of a season, whether he is going to be a Man United long-term starting 11.
And just no, he's just signed a new 3-4 year contract, isn't he?
Yeah, I know. But, you know, say if someone came in and stripped the captaincy off of him because there's a lot of calls that he's maybe not captain material, is he suddenly then wanting out of Man United? Are other clubs looking at his numbers and thinking, actually, we could have him, and he might want to challenge for major honours? I just still wonder whether he'll be at United long term. Signing a new deal doesn't necessarily mean you're there to stay. And just one final point is, I thought it was very kind of poetic, or maybe the opposite of poetic, that Harry Maguire scored a injury time winner to rescue a point for United, and might have just bought Erik ten Hag one more game. Stripped to the captaincy by ten Hag, I think he's unfairly dropped sometimes. I've not seen enough from anywhere near enough from De Ligt to warrant Maguire not starting over him. I think he's normally a really top pro. Harry Maguire gets a really hard time from the media, so I thought it was class for him, but somewhat ironic that he did score late. Look, let's move on from United. Rather depressing. Laurie, let's talk about a club that are way more on the up. Aston Villa do play United this weekend, but before, just want to touch on the fact that they hosted Bayern Munich in the Champions League, and their fans must just be pinching themselves that not only are they competing in the Champions League, but I think they nearly sit top of the table after another win.
Yeah, and again, I think I said at the start of the season, I think the Champions League would be the one for Aston Villa this year to go and put all their eggs in the basket of. And I think quite poetic, it was Bayern Munich. Is it the same as possibly the European final back in 82? Or they had a big game against them that they won back then, and they've managed to kind of repeat that feat. And look, he's done such a good job there, Unai Emery. It's really difficult to pick holes in anything that they do. There's so many clubs that have sort of put their head above the parapet and maybe had a good season before, but they feel like a club that may be here to stay. And I was actually going to say, when we do speak about the Premier League, that me and you were sat in Tenerife watching Ipswich Villa at the weekend, and when they went in front, it actually put them joint top of the league. And I'm not even thinking about Villa in the sort of title race this season, but why not? They're obviously not doing anything unbelievably special, because it surprised me that they were going to be at the top of the league. Okay, they ended up drawing the game, but they're up there this season again, like they were last year. So he's managing to find some consistency, not just in the Premier League, but obviously putting out performances good enough to beat the likes of Bayern Munich in the Champions League as well. So it's probably very, very difficult as a Villa fan to keep your feet on the ground at the moment, because everywhere you look, whether that be how they're doing in the league, Champions League, young players coming through, the likes of Duran, who just seems to... I mean, I looked this morning and he played 23 games last season. I don't remember any of them, but this season he's come off the bench and seems to score every week. There's other Premier League teams trying to table massive offers for him. They seem to have really good strength in depth in every position. There's lots of really good players even on the bench. They're able to rotate and play the likes of Philogene, for instance, in the Champions League and still get results. So, very, very good setup there. Very good side. Really attractive one to be joining at the moment. And if they can do well in the Champions League and the league this year, that will probably unlock the door to them being able to sign the even more elite players, which is what teams outside of the sort of generic big six in England tend to struggle to do. So, fantastic time to be a Villa fan.
Tomo, goal was scored by John Duran. He seems to, like, 75 minutes, Emery just unlocks him and he comes on and scores a wonder goal, or scores a goal for Villa. Do you think long term he's going to be someone who's happy to be sort of off the bench and scoring goals? Or do you think he's, you know, he was linked with like Chelsea and West Ham and clubs like that in the summer. Do you think he's going to long term want to move and be the starting number nine for someone?
Well, long term, I don't think anyone's happy with playing on the bench, are they? And I think... Emery's dealt with that situation absolutely perfectly, because every time he's come on, he has scored. I think he scored 5 off the bench this year. He scored 6 in sort of 280 minutes, I think I saw that stat. And before this season, he was getting linked with moves to Chelsea. He was getting linked with moves to West Ham. And I almost was a little bit like, why? But he's only 20 and he's proven to everyone why he's so highly rated this season. And yeah, even in the interviews with CBS after the game, he basically mentioned how much of a privilege it was to score against a team like Bayern. And because Bayern's the type of club he wants to play for. So even though Aston Villa are high and flying and they're in the Champions League, deservedly so. And like Laura says, I do think they are here to stay. It's like it's a new top six now. I feel like they've got the spending power and the infrastructure to almost to do that before Newcastle, obviously with the Saudi money. So yeah, Duran will probably want to move on just because he looks like an elite level number nine. But the challenge is to overtake Ollie Watkins in that starting position and then produce these performances over 90 minutes as opposed to 20-minute cameos. Will we see that? I'm pretty certain we will soon because he looks absolutely electric every time he's on the bench. And actually, I know the goal on Wednesday or on Tuesday was unbelievable, but his disallowed goal in the last round of the Champions League was just absolutely exquisite. Just first time, sort of Tony Kroos-esque pass into the bottom corner. Absolutely beautiful. He looks like he's got every sort of club in the bag.
Yeah, great. Great player, great young prospect as well. I want to come on to the Premier League in a minute, but Tomo, you've been quite vocal this week around the Champions League format. I think we discussed it on a previous pod as well. Seeing the likes of Villa beating Bayern Munich, Lille beating Real Madrid, I think Benfica thumped Atletico 4-0. Have any of those games or results made you change your mind on the format so far? Has another game week managed to kind of win you over?
No. Not really. No, like obviously those games and those upsets are very good for the clubs who are making those upsets. But because of this new format, it won't really matter on the clubs who lost those games because they're going to qualify anyway. Because the top 24 go through to the knockout phase. No, the biggest concerns I have are like they sold us on this whole there'll be more. Big games among the big clubs. So you've got Real Madrid coming up playing against Liverpool. PSG played Arsenal this week. You had Man City and Inter play last week. But these games don't mean a jot. And what I mean by that is there's literally no jeopardy. So when you're watching the games as a sort of a neutral, what makes football and what makes sport exciting? Jeopardy. Do you know what I mean? If a team loses, they get knocked out. If a team loses, there's something riding on that game. And I just feel like maybe because it's only 2, 3, 4 game weeks in, that the jeopardy won't be there until the 6th, 7th, 8th game, probably the 7th or 8th game. And then the big games might mean a little bit. But even then, what are they playing for in reality? They're playing for to play 2 less extra knockout games. Do you know what I mean? If you want to qualify to get into the last 16 straight away, you've got to get into the top 8. If you lose the 8th game of this league phase and come between 8th and 24th, then you just have to play 2 extra games. So the sort of the jeopardy is basically, do you want to play 2 less games in your ever congested fixture list? So yeah, so look, I'm not sold on it. I wasn't totally sold on the group stage either. So I'm not like sitting here just throwing stones at this format just because I don't like change. And I know last sort of format wasn't perfect, but yeah, not sold on this one.
If I may, I think I've got happy medium. I agree. I think the new format is shocking. I think it should be scrapped already. We're a couple of games in, it's not worked. It's all very well selling us on the fact that they've got big games, but if the big games are friendlies, they might as well be like Man United, Real Madrid over in America in July that they do before the season starts. I think we should return to the old format whereby it's groups of 4, but not seeded. So you talk about jeopardy. Imagine the jeopardy. Although some of those games were boring, at least if there was an upset, then a team starts to think, well, we've got to win the next game because we've only got 6 games in total. Imagine if the draw came out and one group was Real Madrid, Bayern Munich, Man City, all of a sudden. There'd be jeopardy in every single game. And that would also mean that there would probably be some weaker groups, but how competitive are they going to be? Even the crap games, they're thinking, wow, we win a couple of games here, we could be through to the next round. And I think the seeding's put in place to make sure that like the bigger teams sort of get later on in the competition. But if they're good enough, they will anyway. So I think we went back to groups of four, non-seeded. Any team could be in any group. Anyone could play anyone. We'd see really, really competitive games. The draw would be a lot funner because straight away you'd be thinking, blimey, we don't want to be, you know, copping Real Madrid in the group or whatever. There'll be much more in it for the... Because let's be honest as well, we've been through years and years. Man United are a good example of this. You qualify for the Champions League and then you're just not good enough and you get knocked out straight away. And you think, what was the point in finishing fourth? All season we've got to get fourth, got to get fourth, got to get fourth. Get in a group with Roma and Bayern Munich and you're out. Whereas you might get a group where you're going to go further, even as a slightly worse team. And I don't think that takes away from the competition, because if you're good enough, if you're the best team in Europe, you win it anyway. But it gives us more competition and more jeopardy and more watchable games earlier on in the competition. And that's what I'm waiting for a call back from UEFA on currently.
I think that's an absolutely brilliant idea. And for most of those reasons, I think it should happen. But the reality of it is, it's just unrealistic. And I'm not having a pop at UEFA here, because essentially the big clubs in Europe have decided this new format. They wanted more big games. They wanted more games. They wanted more revenue. And UEFA have just almost bowed down to those big clubs, the Real Madrids of this world. And just because they had the Super League hanging over them, didn't they? The threat of the Super League and of all these big clubs leaving the Champions League. So the Champions League have basically sat around a table and gone, or UEFA have sat around a table and gone, well, let's just make the Champions League a Super League. Do you know what I mean? And for Loro's idea to work, you would need the big clubs to basically sign up for it. And they just won't, they wouldn't, would they? Because the jeopardy of essentially potentially getting a group where Real Madrid face Bayern and PSG and Man City, they just wouldn't sign up for that, would they? Even though the fan experience would be much better. And everything that Loro says in terms of the draw, the games, the different sort of knockout rounds, everything would change and be better for the fan, but the clubs wouldn't buy into it, I don't think, which is obviously what we would need for it to change.
And how short-sighted of them. Because, like, you talk about them wanting more games and bigger games for the revenue and all that comes with it, but I don't know what the viewing figures are for a lot of these Champions League games at the minute, but there's so many happening, they can't be huge. Like, if there was more jeopardy and more watchable games earlier on, say Real Madrid got Liverpool in the group stage, then that viewership might double. Do you know what I mean? Like we say, the draw would be so much more exciting. They can make a much bit. I mean, I know they try and make a big event out of it anyway, but it's basically everyone sat in a room waiting to see that Man City have got Sparta Prague and someone from Belgium. Do you know what I mean? If it was like, crikey, Man City have come out of the hat, now it's Madrid. And like this, you know, carnival atmosphere, the whole product could grow in that way if the output was better. But like you say, maybe I'm in dreamland and we've just got to watch these friendlies for the rest of our lives.
No, it's an interesting point. While you guys were chatting that through, I was just looking at this whole kind of jeopardy of fixtures. United have been absolutely shocking so far, drawn with Porto and drawn with Twente. So you'd think they'd be right down there. They're sat within the positions to play the playoff games. Two games, 2 points, 21st in the table. Porto have got 1 point. They'd still qualify as well. You know, you've got teams that are on 0 points in there. So United could have an absolutely shocking group phase. You know, I think they go to Fenerbahce next, where they could very, very likely lose that game. They've then got Rangers. They could pick up a couple wins out of those 8 games and probably comfortably finish within that playoff fixture, where they then back themselves to beat someone like a Midtjylland or a Hoffenheim or a Bodo Glimt that are in there. So, it's not looking good, is it? Like, you can play that badly and still be on course to qualify.
Mathematically, they've worked out that if you get 10 points out of 8 games, you'll qualify. It's impossible not to qualify. So if you take that, for example, that's three wins, 1 draw, 4 losses. Now, there will be a scenario in these big league phases where a club could draw 8 games, lose none, win none, and get through to the knockout phase. What's the point? Do you know what I mean? Loro is absolutely spot on when he calls these games friendlies. It's essentially just filler. It's just appeasing the sponsors, appeasing the TV, it's appeasing everyone except the fans, because these games are terrible and they mean nothing. And then essentially you might as well switch off to these competitions until the last 16 and the quarterfinals, because these games just feel pointless. They honestly feel pointless.
Well, game week 7 and 8 are where it will be interesting in the group stages, right? Because it's going to be like live table coming up of the game, the teams jigging about. And they, you know, if they get a goal here, they'll go into the automatics and they qualify straight away. Do you know, Tomo, when it gets the knockouts, are they going to do like the top 8 are seeded, where they'll have like the away leg first in the knockout and then the playoff game will then, yeah, it'll be like that. So there's the benefit of that. So it's just these first 6 game weeks are just like hard yards. They almost feel like international friendlies, where sometimes, you know, England will play a Belgium, which is a big game in a major tournament. But when it's at Wembley in a friendly, it just doesn't do anything for anyone. And I think that was really showed by Arsenal beating PSG 2-0, which is a great result for them. You know, Havertz and Saka scoring, but there's been such minimal buzz about it. I know PSG haven't got Mbappe and Neymar and Messi anymore, but still a big game and on paper, but just played out like a routine Arsenal win with not much feeling around it. So yeah, I think a lot needs to be done in Europe to win the Pyramid Pod boys over.
And just one last point, Murph, just one last point.
Yeah.
Like the last format with the group stages, it wasn't perfect. And there was a lot of groups that basically played out like this, where you just knew who would qualify, and there was a lots of sort of shit games that sort of meant nothing, because the strong team would be too powerful and too strong and they would just win every match. But there was what, 6 or 8 groups of 4, and in that sort of in the group stage there was always 2 or 3 really good groups that sort of kept you interested and kept you watching. Like for instance, last year, obviously, Man United coming fourth was a bit of a surprise, even though we were terrible. But last year, you had PSG, Dortmund, AC Milan and Newcastle. And it felt like, because there was only 6 games each in that group, every single game was important. So there was something riding on every single one of those big games. And this season, like you just said, PSG come up against Arsenal. It doesn't matter, because even if Arsenal lost that game, they're going to qualify. PSG, they lost that game, it won't matter, because they're going to qualify.
Yeah. No, it's a good point. Very good point. Boys, let's move on to the weekend Prem action. And we've just spoken about United and Villa, and that's the big game of the weekend, really. Loro, last night in our football WhatsApp, you put your Villa and United combined 11 in of Emi Martinez, Ezri Konsa, Carlos, Pau Torres, Digne, Onana, Tielemans, McGinn, Bailey, Watkins and Rodgers, which I laughed at first, but then I actually looked at it and thought through it and thought, do you know what? That he might be being genuine there. That might genuinely be the combined 11 fully Aston Villa team.
Yeah, and the bench was all Villa as well. And that's without a couple of the injured players like your Kamaras and your Mings. But yeah, I don't think there's a... the one player I always put in there was Maynou, but I'm not sure he's been scintillating at the start of this season either. I'm not sure anyone has for Man United. But no, I just think, like we talked about on the plus side of Villa earlier, they've grown into a team that I think are a genuine top 6 team now. And I think you think about the top 6, who are they replacing? You've got to look at Man United, who are 6-7 games in and 13th in the table with 1 win or 2 wins. Fulham, lucky, Xerxes goal, worst player I've ever seen the club sign. And Southampton, who everyone are battering. But other than that, they've not been in the game really. And the ones that they've drawn, they've looked like losing. So yeah, I think that fixture on Sunday is going to be the, if it hasn't happened already with Tottenham last week, I think it's going to be, you know, the Watford one where Solskjaer went and lost 4-0 or whatever it was up at Vicarage Road. And it was like, oh, God, we can't stick by him now, particularly with an international break looming afterwards. That old one where you've got 2 weeks to sort things out and have conversations if they haven't been having them already. My prediction is it will be a wide scoreline in Aston Villa's favour. And we'll probably see Ruud van Nistelrooy in charge come mid-October after the break. What do you think?
I think that United will lose the game very handsomely. I think the Ole Gunnar Solskjaer-Watford comparisons are a really good one, albeit Villa are a lot better side than what Watford were. But I do think it will be one of those wide scorelines where they'll suddenly look at the fact that we've shipped 3 goals against Spurs, 3 against Liverpool, 3 against Porto, and likely 3+ against Villa. I agree with Tomo's point earlier. I think it's absolutely wild that to be 2 and a bit years into a management stint and to give him this Spurs, Porto, Villa run of games to turn it around is the wrong thing to do. I think it's clear to see for everyone that the style of play, the control's not there. And now it seems like he's lost the players. Half, tell you what though, big job for United to do, because half these players and half that squad now are Ten Hag players now, a big Dutch contingency, ex-Ajax contingency with Martinez and Onana. So going to be a big, big job on their hands to turn it round. But yeah, I think it's going to be a very comprehensive Villa victory and the end of Ten Hag. And I've seen that Sir Jim Ratcliffe is going to be at the game, which almost feels a little bit like Grim Reaper sat in the stands like, yeah, I've seen it. I've seen the eye test now and that's enough for me. Tomo?
Manchester United have lost once in 29 years at Villa Park. And do you know who that was under?
Erik ten Hag.
2022, we lost at Villa Park, and we do usually have a very good record here. But to your point, Murph, I just find it absolutely bonkers that if Man United get away with a win this weekend, he has a stay of execution. What is the point? Like I said, it feels like we're in this sort of purgatory where you're neither going to heaven and you're neither going to hell. You're just stuck. And you're basically stuck with Ten Hag for the rest of time and you're just miserable.
There's an argument. I'm listening to a Man United podcast, Talk of the Devils. There's an argument that was being made on there, which is Ineos might just grip this out with Ten Hag now. Like, I think Arteta was in his third season with Arsenal and they'd played the first 3 games of the season, lost all 3 games, were sat bottom of the Premier League. It felt like Arteta was right on the cusp of being sacked. I imagine you boys remember it, where it was almost like he's got to go now. We're bottom of the Premier League. But they've stuck by him and they've obviously improved things around Arsenal, the way that they're run. And now they're bearing the fruits of that labour. So it might be that United get battered by Aston Villa and everyone's like, well, that's him done. But actually, they are now just backing him. But I don't know. I can't see how that's going to happen or why they would do that.
Well, they completely eroded whatever little authority he had over that squad over the summer when they clearly publicly courted the likes of Thomas Tuchel. I think it seemed like they wanted like a chat with Gareth Southgate, Thomas Frank, Marco Silva. It seemed like basically they were scouring the managerial market for anyone. And then eventually they travelled over to Ibiza, disturbed Erik ten Hag on his holiday and almost interviewed him for the job that he already had. Do you know what I mean? So yeah. Those players are returning from pre-season and they're looking at ten Hag going, this ain't lasting long. So why should I almost follow your instructions? Because you'll be gone before I am.
Laurie, did you want to come in?
Am I right? If I remember rightly, when was it at the start of the season? Was it Erik ten Hag's first 2 games where you got beat badly at Brentford and I think you lost at home to Brighton? Was that his first 2 games?
Yeah, and we landed off my stag do, do you remember? And like we just lost to Brighton and then it was like United were going to sign Rabiot and Arnautovic. And it was like, then it was suddenly like, oh shit, no, we need to go and get, and we got Casemiro off the back of it.
Yeah, it's just after 6 games that season, I expect it looked better than it does now. It's just not moving anywhere. It's moving backwards. Your squad's probably worse now. Like, genuinely, do either of you see the... do you think you've signed the right player in Xerxes? Do you reckon that's the guy that was identified?
No, but can we... I just want to say with Xerxes, and I feel a little bit sorry for him, but he was signed essentially as a backup to Hoyland and he's just been thrown in at the deep end. So he might be a good alternative, but clearly he doesn't seem to be at that level to be starting for Manchester United right now. But he's just sort of, Ten Hag's hand has been forced a little bit by starting him every week.
He's not at the level to start for Boston United, though. Like, Louis Sahar was a backup striker. Do you know what I mean? Bring someone in like that, no problem. Duran at the moment is a backup striker. He's young as well. I'm not feeling sorry for him. Okay, he might not be scintillating, but you've still got to look like you're a footballer. Honestly, I've not seen a player that bad in a long time. Any team in the league, any team.
Yeah, I'm a bit less pragmatic on Xerxes. I think he is absolutely dog shit.
I think he's done a couple of things well. He just missed a hell of a lot of chances, easy chances.
He's always stretched chances. It's almost like he turns a good chance into a half chance. So if he misses it, he can be like, I was on the stretch. He's constantly stretching for the ball. Just fucking meet the ball, Joshua. I thought it was shit against Fulham when he scored the goal. I thought he came on and I was like, he looks alarming. He looks alarmingly clumsy and shit. And he's not like any better since.
Murph, that's the title for this podcast now, Clumsy and Shit.
Alarmingly clumsy and shit. Well
done. We got to move on from United because everyone's bored to tears of them. And yeah, we speak about them constantly. Just a little bit on the Pyramid Pod FPL, because we've not done an update in a while. Chap called Matthew Smith with the team, the Kanate kid, so assuming a Liverpool fan, is on 456 points, which I think means he's on more points than the three of us combined, is leading the way for the Pyramid Podcast table. Favourable fixtures this week for Chelsea, Arsenal, Liverpool and Man City. So again, could see some big scores coming in. But yeah, well done to Matthew or Matt, who is leading the way at the moment.
Yeah, and good. Just quickly, Murph, good luck to Fulham, who travelled to Man City for the sixth time this season.
Yeah, it does always seem to be Haaland scoring a hat-trick against them. Moving on to the EFL, and Loro, Friday night, Leeds in action at the Stadium of Light against Sunderland, first versus fifth. Leeds in a very decent run of form. Could go top, actually, if they win by enough goals, but looks like a tough game, that one.
Yeah, really tough game. I think Leeds looks so ominous. Like, really, like, we haven't even hit our stride. And I just look at the table, and God knows how we're 3 points off top, because we've dropped quite a few points. We drew the first game of the season to Portsmouth. We got out of Carrow Road only with a point at the weekend, but we're 3 points off top. That league doesn't have a runaway this year until we do hit our stride. And if we go to the Stadium of Light tonight and beat Sunderland, that will be the statement. And that will probably be the sort of kickstart to us. You know, you sort of look back at the table at Christmas and, oh, Leeds are 15 points clear. That's what I foresee happening. Will that happen? I don't know. Sunderland are on a quest of a wave at the minute. They've started the season well. An unknown manager, to me anyway. I thought that was going to be an absolute disaster. Got that one horribly wrong. But sometimes you can see teams at the top of the championship in sort of September, October, and quickly dwindle down. Whether or not that happens to Sunderland, who knows? But yeah, really interesting game to see where both clubs are at the moment tonight. And I'll be watching on really excitedly. We've actually just lost Gruev, who's going to have to come out the team with an injury for a few weeks now. So I think the Japanese boy will be coming in, Tanaka. So we'll see how he gets on. But I'm really pleased with Leeds at the moment. Every game I watch them, we're just battering every team we play. And although it hasn't been reflected in all the score lines, it will do at some point. We've got too much quality. And yeah, I think this is exactly the same as what I said last week. I'm really confident every game that we go into. So really tough game for Leeds, but an even tougher one for Sunderland, I think, tonight.
Just before we move on from Sunderland, boys, implore all of our listeners and our viewers to watch Joe Bellingham's first goal of the season. Sunderland beat Derby 2-0 on Wednesday, I think, or Tuesday. And Bellingham popped up with the first goal and is an absolute thunder bastard.
Yeah, great goal that. And Laurie, just quickly on Leeds as well, you seem to have your own version of John Duran with Joel Pirro just coming off the bench and getting 20 minutes but scoring every game.
Yeah, interesting one that, because, you know, start of the season, you thought, oh, Matteo Joseph's come in and taken the sort of starting centre forward role, Pirro's on the bench. And then you look at the goal scoring charts and Pirro's, I think, third in the league, joint third in the league or something. So is that good management, or is it, oh, Pirro's doing too much to be left on the bench now, and will he come back into the starting lineup at some point? I actually hope it's the latter. I think, you know, young lad Joseph, he's clearly a good player, scored bags of goals in the reserves, scored a really good goal at Chelsea last year in the FA Cup, I remember, but it's a long season, the Championship. He ain't going to want to be starting 46 games. So I think there's going to be a period where he might come out of the team. And I think if Joel Pirro gets in, he's going to be thinking, I need to take this chance now and be the Joel Pirro that I was at Swansea. And the Joel Pirro that Leeds thought they were signing. He hasn't been ridiculously bad. He's just been probably a little bit below par in contrast to his own in comparison to his own standards. So, yeah, happy with Pirro's start. I really love him as a player. I really, really like him, and I hope to see his goal scoring form continue. He's a great finisher, and he's a good player to have on your side.
And just one other game in the Championship, or one piece of news that I want to highlight, is Burnley have got Preston tomorrow, but Preston will be out without forward Milutin Osmazic, who scored a brace as Preston beat Watford 3-0 on Wednesday night. However, he's just been handed an 8-game ban and a 15 grand fine for biting Blackburn defender Owen Beck. I think from memory, Owen Beck got sent off for something like a challenge in that game, and that Osmazic just bit him. And I'm not sure if he got booked or not, didn't have any action taken against him. But yeah, 8 games for him. So he's likely to be out till around December now. So yeah, don't bite people, I guess. In League One,
I was just going to say, I hate to do like this whataboutery stuff, but it does seem like the FA punish biting people more than they do racism, don't they? But I don't know which is worst, but it feels like someone got banned for 4 games for racism, and this guy's getting banned for 8 games for biting.
I think just the safest bet is to not be racist or to bite.
Yeah, true.
In League One, Birmingham have won their last 7 league games, and the money they've spent looks to be telling already. Interestingly, though, second, third and fourth spots in that league are occupied by Wrexham, Mansfield and Stockport. Now, we speak quite a bit about Wrexham and we spoke a lot about Stockport as well. But Laurie, just wondered if you could just give us a little bit of insight about what Mansfield have got going on.
Well, firstly, they've got a really good manager, obviously, in Nigel Clough, son of Brian, who's had a decent spell there. And just going back many years, the 1 year that Yeovil Town were in the Championship, he was actually Derby gaffer that year. And it's the best footballing team I've ever seen at Hewish Park. So he's a really good coach and a really good manager. They've got some good players. It seemed like they finished sixth or seventh for about 10 years in a row in League Two. So obviously, talk about Wrexham and Stockport, they're on a crest of a wave coming out of the National League. Mansfield have been that kind of nearly team in that league for a while, and have just been waiting for that one where they go up. And they've got some really good experienced players. Aidan Flint's there. They've got Jordan Barry, the old Villa centre forward, who's a right back for them. They've got Stephen Quinn, the little Ginger Zidane that's been around the EFL for many years. And more importantly, now they've got some really good forward players. And I think Lee Gregory is one of the top scorers in League One for them at the moment. He's been at sort of Stoke and Millwall and Sheffield Wednesday more recently. They've got Will Evans, who I think's the Newport lad, isn't he, that scored against Man United last year. So if you look at their team, it's no surprise that they're doing well. But yeah, obviously the lesser mentioned of the three that have come up from last year, but that's probably a good thing for them. They've sort of gone under the radar. But when you've got a good manager and a good set of players, and you're a team that's been building quite slowly but surely over a number of years, they've got quite a solid foundation now to go and have a really good go at League One. And it's good to see that they're doing it. And it's good for clubs in the National League and in League Two to think that, like you say, 3 of the top 5 at the moment are the ones that went up from last year. So, and that's in a really tough league as well. If you can get up, you've got a really good chance of doing something. So, yeah, fair play to Mansfield, and also fair play to Stockport and Wrexham who are doing their thing. But if you look at that table, it's a little bit ominous with Birmingham now, isn't it? I think they're like 3 points clear with the game in hand, and they've drawn one and won the rest. So I think that one's going to turn into maybe a one-horse race, and it'll be a bit of a battle to see who can get that second automatic spot.
Well, as a sign of how confident Birmingham are of getting promoted, their captain come out, I think it was at the start of this week, and basically said, "We're too good for League One." And when you're saying that 8 games in, you're basically putting a target on your back, because most clubs in that league will think, well, let's show him now. But they're just that good and far beyond any other club in that league that it doesn't matter if they have a target on their back. They'll probably have a target on their back anyway, because they're the biggest club in that league. But yeah, their captain's come out, said we're too good for the league and we're going to win every game, which is insane, really.
The problem is that would apply pressure if he was wrong, but he's just right, isn't he? They've got a squad that's quite expensively assembled, even by Championship standards. So they're doing, like, if you remember Newcastle when they came down to the Championship, it's like tough league, but we're just too good. Yeovil, the famous one when they went down to National League South, tough league, but far too good. And I think the same at Wrexham in the National League when the Hollywood came in. I think the same applies to Birmingham. And it wouldn't actually surprise me if they had an invincible season, to be honest with you.
I was looking, actually, they beat Peterborough 3-2 and they had sort of Lyndon Dykes off Jay Stansfield, and then they just freshened it up midweek to beat Huddersfield 1-0 and brought Alfie May in, who scores about, 25 goals in that league every season. He just came in for Lyndon Dykes and played off of Stansfield and scored a goal. So, you know, they're beating sides there in Huddersfield and Peterborough, who are going to be some of the main protagonists, you'd imagine, towards the end of the season in that league. But I know Huddersfield have been struggling big time, but, you know, they've been in the Championship and Premier League quite recently. So, yeah, ominous signs for Birmingham. Invincible season might be a good shout, Laura. The one promoted team from League Two who aren't doing as well, though, is Crawley. And, Laura, they've recently lost their manager as well, Scott Lindsay, who's dropped down a division to go and take the MK Dons role. Am I right in saying that Crawley, like, absolutely battered MK Dons in the playoffs, like 8-0 or something on aggregate last year as well?
Yeah. Yeah, I just think Crawley were actually favourites to go down and finish rock bottom in League Two last season. Hence, Scott Lindsay getting a very good reputation for himself, getting them into the playoffs and winning it so convincingly. I think it was Crewe they might have had in the final and won that easily as well. Got some good, I think, money into the club from the sale of a couple of the players, the likes of that Orsi that I think went to Burton or something like that, and one or two other players that they'd have got fees for. And I think his stock has risen again because they've gone into League One. You say they're struggling, but they're not in the relegation zone or anything like that, are they? I think they're sort of somewhere in the mid to bottom half, which is almost like their like playoffs, if you like, because this is a team that was supposed to go down from League Two last season, have lost their best players and are still holding their own. So I think when you see a manager that is overperforming on such a tight budget in a club that have very modest expectations, that's when it catches the eyes. And although he's going to a club in the league below, MK Dons have probably got a much higher ceiling, haven't they? They've got that big stadium in the middle of nowhere and new ownership. And, you know, they've sort of got that feel about them that they've been in the Championship before, that they could probably go a little bit further than maybe what Crawley can. So, yeah, very strange twist of events because MK Dons seemingly got rid of Mike Williamson, although he went to Carlisle straight away. Scott Lindsay's gone in at MK Dons. And who replaces Scott Lindsay at Crawley? Rob Elliott, the guy that was the assistant manager at Gateshead before Mike Williamson went to MK Dons. Mike Williamson goes to MK Dons. Rob Elliott does such a good job at Gateshead. He's now in League One above his old boss. So it's a weird old merry-go-round. Rob Elliott finding himself at a League One club above, you know, his predecessor at both his new club and his old club. So good for him. I think Scott Lindsay could do a good job at MK Dons, and I think Mike Williamson's probably got a bit of rebuilding to do in terms of his reputation and his stock at Carlisle. But strange twist of events, and it'd be interesting to see how Elliott gets on up at Crawley and likewise at Lindsay at MK Dons.
Particularly interesting considering he's a goalkeeper, because you rarely see goalkeeper managers, don't you? I know Nuno Espirito Santo is flying that flag in the Premier League, but other than that, you rarely see goalkeepers go into management, do you?
Who's the, maybe a question for our listeners, who is the best ever goalkeeper manager who's gone into management?
Mourinho was a goalie, wasn't he?
He was very good, was he?
I think Nigel Adkins was a goalie. He got a couple of promotions here and there. Andy Woodman was a goalkeeper. And he's doing great guns at Bromley. But obviously, that's only one promotion so far for him from the National League to League Two. Like you say, Espirito Santo is probably going to be right up there in that list, isn't he? I just feel like there's a burning one. But I can't think.
Yeah, let us know. Get in touch. Let us know. I'm sure there's a few listeners who will have a shout of who it will be. Right. Also, just one final point as well on Crawley is that looking at the game run of games they've had recently, they've had Mansfield, Wrexham, Stockport, who we've all just spoken about and how well they're doing, Barnsley, who are a good League One side, and Bolton, who are a top League One side as well. So they've had a really tricky run of games there. So hopefully some more favourable fixtures coming up for Rob Elliott, and he can start to pick up some points there for Crawley. And then, Laurie, just want to move on to National League as well and get our weekly Yeovil update. Obviously, we were on holiday last weekend, so you were unable to go, but Yeovil back on the score sheet against Aldershot after a run of games without a goal. But Dagenham and Redbridge home this weekend, and probably about time for Yeovil to pick up 3 points.
Yeah, we need a home win. We've got a couple of new players in recently, lad up front, McGuckin from Rotherham on loan. We've also taken a player called, I think his name's James Plant from Port Vale. And looking at the Port Vale fans on Twitter at his exit tweet, you know, it was very much a case of we want him back. Very good player. You know, quite surprised he's going down to National League. I know Mark Cooper said he sort of wasn't really looking for anyone, but when that one came up, couldn't say no. I think he can play left back, right back, right wing, left wing, cam. So a good versatile player that should maybe be too good for the level, and he's young as well. So some good additions have been made. I hope we get 3 points tomorrow, but we're playing the Dagenham and Redbridge side that are, they put 7 past Gateshead last week in the league, who were top of the league and unbeaten. So they've obviously got goals in the team. I know they've got a young winger called Dion Pereira, who we very briefly had on loan at Yeovil from Luton a couple of years ago. He's been sort of in and around the EFL echelons, and at one point they obviously thought he was going to be a championship player, and one or two others there as well. So I think it'll be a tough game, but I think they score a lot of goals and maybe play a little bit more open than a lot of the sides that we've played so far. So hopefully it'll be a good game, and yes, be very good if you can get 3 points on the board, because we're in that kind of mid-table position at the moment, and it looks like it can kind of go one way or the other. You don't just want to tread water and be there all season and sort of draw one, lose one, win one. Hopefully we can get a run of games together and get some points on the board. So yeah, Yeovil Dagenham, Hewish Park tomorrow. If you're not doing anything, get down there, because that'd be a good game.
I've seen that they entered that National League Cup that Yeovil and a few of the other sides didn't enter, and they played Tottenham under 21s midweek and drew
5-5.
Yeah, five.
I was going to say, they score goals, don't they? They're obviously playing quite expansively and forward-thinking, which is good. I like it when teams come to Hewish Park and do that, because it makes for a good game and it gives us a bit more space and excitement as fans in the home end. So not really sure what to expect other than a lively one. And as always, we want 3 Glovers points.
Definitely. Right, boys, that's all we got time for. We'll be back next week, where we will review all of the action upcoming this weekend. And we will probably be talking about who's going to be the next manager at Manchester United. Cheers, boys. Pleasure as always.
Cheers, boys. 1, 2, 3.